So I'm going to read you a poem by a mystic of medieval India. She's called Meera. My eyes stretched wide see only sleep. I hear tell there used to be a lonely royal girl like me upon a time. Gazing from the palace walls was all her life, until unwarned her eyes lit on another's smile, like beads that make each other shine. There is yet one. Her tears stitched gleaming pearls all night. Says Meera, I count the stars. I wait for one pin of light. So this morning I'm just going to introduce a little bit more spiritual receptivity, because that's really the quality that we're looking for to develop on this retreat. Well, not just on this retreat, in our whole Dharma life, but that's what this retreat is focused on. And I was thinking about what spiritual receptivity means. And I was thinking it's a funny kind of quality. It's a quality. It's not really a thing you do. It's a quality of being. Subhuti calls it dharmic responsiveness. But in a way, you have to just start with responsiveness. Responsiveness. Being alive to the significance of things, being alive to what's in your experience, and noticing where that leads you. I was thinking, in a way, it's being alive to what is Gambhira. Gambhira means sort of secret or hidden. Could also mean sort of the beyond. And what I was thinking is that suggests to me that quality of something that lies behind all experiences, where instead of, as I said in the introduction, instead of just looking at things in terms of what one can get out of them, because that's what we usually do, we're looking at our experiences are sort of calibrated or interpreted in terms of what they can give us, how they feed the ego project, in a sense. And once we drop that, once we sort of loosen that relationship to the world on the basis of craving, one can see, in the words of Wordsworth, into the life of things. Into the life of things behind our grasping.
Excuse me, Patrick, could you please just say the meaning of Gambhira?
Gambhira means a sort of secret or hidden. So yes, so it's the sort of secret that lies behind all experiences if we just open ourselves to them. And the faculty that we use to open ourselves to those experiences, well, one could describe it as the faculty of imagination. So just to remind you, a power or capacity of the individual, having in it something that is more than the individual, that transforms the objects of experience and unifies them. So it's a faculty that we all have that leads us beyond ourselves and beyond that relationship of grasping, grasper and grasping, which is how we usually relate to the world. And it unifies them into a sort of, if you can see the secret behind things, it unifies the objects of experience into something of reality, into an understanding of reality. One could call that pratichasamutpada, conditioned arising, or understand it in terms of elections. And in a way, that experience that we have, and I'm sure we've all had experiences like that, where we just, we see into the life of something. We're going along our ordinary daily existence. And then suddenly something makes us stop and have a deeper reflection of things. I think we've all had that, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And I definitely started having those kind of experiences when I was a child, where I could just suddenly see something. in a way from its own side, not just in terms of an ordinary state of life, mind. I remember actually coming out of a study group once. So I often have this experience after doing Dharma study, and I came out, we were in Rijamitra's coal shed. I don't know why we were having a study session in Rijamitra's coal shed, which is where he lived in Leeds at that time. And I remember coming out of that study group and just seeing this spider on a leaf. And it was just extraordinary. It was like the first time I've ever seen a spider. And I stood there for a long, long time. I remember that. Anyway, so that's just a small example of that experience. And it comes on the basis of developing integration and positive emotion. So, you know, we're refining our states of mind. We work to refine our states of consciousness so that we're integrated, we're moving in the same direction, and we're skillful. We're developing skillful states of mind, positive states of mind. But on the basis of that, on the basis of that integration and positive emotion, we need a sort of space, because integration and positive emotion require quite a large effort of will. And it's almost like when we do the work, we need to allow ourselves to have a space in which that work that we've done, that merit that we've made, can open up and flourish. If we don't give ourselves that space, and this is what retreats are always about, we end up in a very utilitarian consciousness, even in relation to the Dharma life, which is about a kind of constant process of self-improvement, you know, which is great. We all need to do that. If you don't undertake the projects of self-improvement, you're just going to make a mess, basically, in the world. So, so we need to do that project of self-improvement. But if we don't give ourselves space for that to flourish, for that merit to flourish, that's all it will be. And I think retreats are a way to give ourselves that space. And this mythic context retreat, you could see, is creating a context, a mythic context, for your merit to flourish, to open up in mysterious ways that perhaps you hadn't thought of. I remember there was this convention. It was an extremely strong experience for everyone involved, where we turned up to the evening puja at Wyndham. So I think there was probably, 400 or 500 order members there. And we all came to the puja. And you know what happens at the beginning of puja? People are sort of wittering on a bit. And then it went silent. And some people were standing next to their cushions and some people were sitting down. And we were waiting for the puja to start. And we waited. And we waited. And then you could see everyone looking at each other thinking, what's going on? Parami was leading the puja, or so we thought, and then you could hear someone whispering to someone and someone walking out, clearly to go and find her. And so we just sat there, or stood there. We didn't need to do anything about it. We weren't going to go anywhere, and we weren't going to do anything. We weren't even going to sit down and start the puja. We just waited for Parami to arrive, which eventually she did. And every single person who was in that room said something extraordinary happened. And it was almost because we dropped even trying to do a puja. We dropped trying to leave, you know, or we didn't need to sort it out. You could clearly hear that Lokeshwar had gone to sort it out as a fine parami. So we didn't need to do anything. We could just have to stand there or sit there. And it was, but we weren't just sitting there or standing there in isolation. We were with each other in a very, very positive context. Something emerged. So really we could see this as a journey. In my journey to Il Convento, Bhante talks about a journey that one makes, even an inner mystical journey from the karma loka, the realm of sensory experience, where one relates to the objects of experience in terms of grasping, to the rupa loka, the realm of archetypal form, where everything becomes a symbol of something deeper. And even the Arupa Loka, which is the realm of very, very subtle form, which is in a way beyond form itself. Another way that you could describe this, and I won't go into these in detail, is the five eyes. I've always been really interested in this Buddhist doctrine of the five eyes, which Subhuti just mentions briefly in Reimagining the Buddha paper. So according to Buddhism, there's five eyes. There's the fleshy eyes, so, you know, the actual eyes that we're used to seeing with. But then there's the divya eyes, the divya shakshu, which is like the divine eye that's able to see, in a way, a slightly different world, maybe able to see gods and goddesses, maybe able to see people who are not physically present with us. The more mysterious eye, I think this is more akin to the sort of being in the Rupa Loka, where you've got your sensory experience, but there's a different sort of, in a way, the inner eye of the mystic. Then there's the Dharma eye that sees the Dharma in everything, that sees the Lakshanas, for example, seeing everything as impermanent, devoid of inherent selfhood, and unable to give us the lasting satisfaction that we usually desire. And then there's the Prajna eye, the eye of wisdom. And then even more mysterious is the Samanta Shakshu, which is the universal eye. It's up on the board. The universal eye, which is the eye of the Buddha. Interestingly, I believe, and I need to check this, but I believe that this is the eye that opened for the Buddha after his enlightenment, and he saw all beings as like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. And when he saw all beings like lotuses reaching from the light and able to open out into the light, he trembled. He had the anukampa, he trembled with all beings. So I think I just like the doctrine of the five eyes, because I think it's speaking to us of an experience that we have, that we see with something more than just the eye, the fleshy eye. We start to open the eye of the inner mystic. And I think this is also part of this retreat, is developing the inner mystic, the mystic within. Bhante talks about the inner guru, but I think there's also the inner mystic. And it might be good to get in contact with that in yourself on this retreat. One could even draw her. What does she look like, your inner mystic? You know, you could make a shrine to her. What kind of shrine does your inner mystic want? Does she want a shrine sort of filled with feathers and bits of old wood and bones, which you're not going to bring inside because they'll start to smell? just to make a little caveat on that, or does your inner mystic like flowers and berries, and or does she like silks and crystal rosaries? I don't know. So yes, so spiritual receptivity. What is it not? That's also a good thing to ask myself. What is it not? And I think the sort of antithesis of spiritual receptivity is literalism. And Bhante defines literalism as an idea of the Arya Pariyasana, which means the noble quest. So an idea of the noble quest or the spiritual life, grasped with the intellect powered by craving. So what happens is we set up an idea about what the spiritual life should be and should involve. And we fix to that idea, not realizing that we've just created an idea of the spiritual life based on our own intellect powered by craving, which is fundamentally our own craving. There's a wonderful quote, actually it's a very good paper by Arloka about navigating the labyrinth of literalism. And it's got some great one-liners in it. Anyway, so one of the one-liners is, how tedious if Dharma practice always conform to what we expected, and our naive bletherings, which for the non-native English speakers amongst us, I have no idea how to translate bletherings, Our naive blatherings means just like blah, 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 blah. Like that. So how tedious if Dharma practice always conformed to what we expected, and our naive blatherings about enlightenment bore even the remotest relationship to its eventual realisation. So basically, wouldn't it be awful if enlightenment was what you think it is now? Wouldn't it be awful if the spiritual life is like you think it is now? My goodness. It's much better than that. But of course, that's what we do. We have an idea, which we imagine as the goal of the spiritual life, and then we have to let that go. We have to drop it. And in a way, our spiritual life, and in fact, the whole history of Buddhism, that's what Bhante points out in the survey, the whole history of Buddhism and the individual life of the Buddhist is setting up one idea about the nature of the spiritual life or the nature of enlightenment, one idea after another, and then having to let it go. It's what Aloka calls a path of debris, which offers us the consolation that we've actually moved from where we've started. So one really has to be alive to the mystery. Once you start fixing the spiritual life and think you've understood, that is the danger. If you think you've understood it, then by definition you haven't. So it's important to notice where we tie things down, where we assume that we've understood and we know. Because I think what happens is that we can either tie things down to a very little conception of ourselves. That's one thing that people do. So we've got an idea, you know, I can't meditate. I'm just a bit of a, sloth of the spiritual life. I'm a little ordinary person. And we tie the nature of the spiritual life. You know, if I can be, in this lifetime, if I could just be a little bit more happy and a little bit kinder to others, then that's enough. So we tie ourselves to quite a small sphere. And we all do this, actually. It's important to notice where we've kind of bound ourselves to quite a small conception of ourselves. And then it usually comes along with waiting for other people in the order to do the big stuff. You know, other people in the order to be the stream entrance in enlightenment, or other people in the order to take responsibilities and step into responsibility and things like that. So we tie ourselves to this little conception of ourselves. It's just quite boring, actually. It's quite boring and it doesn't really serve anyone. Least of all oneself. We are establishing Buddhism a new culture. It's not going to help if Dharmacharanis think they're rubbish or think they're little. It really isn't. Like, who's going to do it if not you? You live at the time of the Buddha. We all do, you know, we live in the time of the Buddha Sasana. We have the conditions necessary to practice the spiritual life. It's really not going to help if we all kind of step into the shadows with that all the time. So we can tie ourselves down to our littleness, and we can also, in a way, tie ourselves down to big experiences. I think that's the other thing. We can have an experience, even quite a big experience, and then we can fix ourselves on that. And that can also be a bit of a trap, I think, because even big experiences are just big experiences. And sometimes they can limit us, actually. I do remember being on solitary retreat and I realised I was very blocked in my practice and I couldn't work out why I was so blocked. And I realised that a friend of mine had been having very strong visionary experiences. And because they were having very strong visionary experiences, I thought that in a way I needed to have those experiences or my practice was a bit rubbish. So I was really trying to push for a big experience. And then I thought, well, that's just ridiculous. Just trust the Dharma, trust the conditions of the Dharma. And when I did that, and just meditated and did my practice, and something opened up for me that was, in a strange way, probably one of the biggest experiences I'd had on a solitary retreat, but it also at the same time felt very ordinary. So I think we can trap ourselves in the idea of a big experience as well. In a way, the spiritual life is a mystery, and spiritual receptivity is about becoming alive to the mystery. So how do we do this? How do we develop spiritual receptivity? I think the first thing is just to notice when we come alive. And not an idea of where we come alive. Not where I should come alive. But moment by moment, where I'm coming alive now. Not even where I've come alive in the past. You know, we can grasp an idea of what makes us come alive. And we say, oh, well, listen, this does it for me. And then it doesn't anymore. So one has to notice it in one's current experience without trying to work out why or if one should or shouldn't come alive with that thing. The first thing is just to notice, ah, okay, something in me has just responded. There's a response there to something. You can work out why later. But in that moment, noticing where we come alive. Yeah, even if it's quite odd or even quite simple or even just momentary. Ah, something happened there. I'll tell you another little story, which is there's in this book about a Tibetan guru. He's got a Western disciple who asked him for a teaching, which comes in this very elaborate ritual. So he's a very experienced Dharma teacher and some sort of Rinpoche. And he does all this kind of really elaborate ritual, which is this initiation of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. And he keeps on getting it wrong. So the Western disciple is really disappointed because he's sitting there and the guru is doing this thing. And then the guru's attendant keeps on saying to him, you meant to do that first. And he says, oh, sorry, yeah, no, I've got that wrong. And then they go in this kind of slightly clunky way. And the disciple just doesn't feel anything. You know, it's this elaborate ritual that the guru keeps on getting wrong, is corrected by his attendant. And he doesn't really feel like the initiation's happened. So they go out after that. They go out for to have some tea and just talk about things. It's taken a long time. And they're just chatting. And as they're talking about the Dharma and about Dharma life, and the disciple suddenly feels really inspired and awake. And he feels very, very touched and warm. And he feels like something is happening in the communication that's beyond ordinary communication. There's what Bhante calls a vital mutual responsiveness. And he feels lit up and energized. And after a while, he says to the Tibetan guru, that was the initiation, wasn't it? And the guru says, yes. So yes, even those momentary glimpses. And I think it's really important also to notice where we don't come alive. Where's the rub? There's a book by John Strong. He's talking about the Sarvastivadin tradition, and he makes the point that in early Buddhism, all images of the Buddha have an image of presence and absence. So you have the empty throne, or the empty feet, or you have next to a Buddha Rupa, you have a stupa. And he said, in a way, what this is trying to symbolise is that one always has to hold both presence, a real feel of the Buddha being there and having been enlightened, and us being able to tune into that, and also the fact that the Buddha is no longer with us in that form. And he says, in the way the Sarvastivadins really worked with that juxtaposition, where do I come alive and where have I gone? Where do I feel the Buddha and where do I feel the Buddha's absence? Where do I feel just my own kleshas, my own mental preoccupations? When do I feel engaged and when do I feel bored? And I think we're always working with those rubs. So for example, in the Going for Ashwamedha prostration practice, I think the moment where you feel resistance is as interesting as the moment where you feel engaged. Or particularly myself, I think, oh, okay, I've encountered resistance. So what's going on? How can I relax through that as well? There's other kind of conflicts that we come into relationship with. We've sometimes, particularly with the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice, We've got an idea. We have to do it as a collective. We do the same stages of the practice at the same stage, including the prostrations, which would be very clunky if we didn't. And yet, sometimes one feels an inspiration to do something a bit different as an individual. Or you've got this collective tree, and which is a kind of collective myth or vision. And then one feels, yes, but I don't know anything about, I don't know, Shitigarbha or Huineng or something, and I want these, you know, where's White Tara or where's Pranayaparamita? Where are the figures that I respond to? So, in a way, I think one shouldn't be frightened of that. I think that rub is interesting because it forces us to go beyond ourselves. You can also feel it of in terms of the images of sort of Indo-Tibetan culture, and then feeling, well, actually, I don't respond to that. I respond to things much more within my own culture. So we shouldn't be frightened of that dichotomy, that rub between the two things, because something very exciting can come out of that creative tension, because we have to go to a higher state of consciousness that isn't just, well, I'm going to invent my own path based on my culture and what I respond to. And yet one can't just go completely of like, I'm going to accept the path of others and confine myself to that. So, yes, those rubs are interesting, and it's good to explore what happens there. And I think all of this does require a certain amount of effort. I think receptivity does require effort. But a particular kind of effort, and Bhante calls this kind of effort, it's the effort, when he's talking about four right efforts, he says it's being aesthetically active. That's the nature of right effort. So we're always looking at what's arisen in our experience and whether it's beautiful, whether it's Kalyana, whether it represents what's good, true and beautiful in it, our experience, or whether it isn't. Always noticing, ah, yes, this is arisen and it's beautiful and it's of the nature of the spiral path, one could say. And what the Buddha said about the spiral path is he said, you don't need to make an act of will to ascend the spiral path. If one can be receptive and open to what is beautiful, what is of the nature of the spiral path, one just ascends naturally. But we have to also notice where the spiral path is in our experience and allow ourselves to just open to that and to flow in a way up the spiral path. But it's also looking at what isn't Kalyana. Actually, there's a kind of being aesthetically active is a sort of shrinking back from what's in a way ugly and painful, and just letting that go in its own way. Bring it back to the earth. And also it's being aesthetically active to know what we want to arise and what the conditions we need are for that to happen. So I think it's very interesting that Shantavadri started us off in the puja the other night with 20 minutes to prepare. And I found that a very rich experience. Because also I noticed that everyone knew, we all knew what we wanted to do and we did something that helped us. So that's really us trusting that we know the conditions that we need. That's being aesthetically active. What do I need now? What do I need now to be receptive to the refuge tree in my experience? Now, you know, right this minute. And set up those conditions for us to open. I think this is a big part of solitary retreats as well, of like, oh, I can notice my mind is becoming a bit closed. It's becoming a bit isolated and a bit heavy. That's what I notice. So what do I need to do? And then noticing, yes, well, my mind is expansive and open to the nature of things. So how can I just allow that to flourish, in a sense? So it's that. It's noticing the shrinking of the mind and noticing the expansion of the mind and knowing how to bring that about, how to help that process, the shrinking, the expansion. And if we can do that, if we can work with our mind in a way that's aesthetically active and receptive and responsive, we become attuned to the life of things, we become attuned to beauty. And then something can happen when we meet something that represents the truly beautiful. Subhuti and Panti talk about is the illumined imagination meeting the illumined image. An illumined imagination can meet an image that embodies a state of mind that's higher. So it doesn't have to be necessarily sort of Buddhist or religious in nature. It could be that it represents a higher value, something of true value. And when the illumined imagination meets that illumined image, I mean, you know, for us, a beautiful image of the Buddha would serve that purpose. It doesn't have to be the Buddha. But if the illumined imagination meets the illumined image, both are reflected in each other. You are reflected in the image, and the image is reflected anew. And Bhante says that when we're truly receptive, we are receptive with the whole of ourselves, and we become that image. We are transported to the world to which the image belongs, and we become an inhabitant of that world. He talks about image perceiving image. So something happens in that. Traditionally, one could call it the samaya sattva, which is the being of the bond. So that's you with your commitment. Samaya means sort of commitment or bond. It means you've made a commitment to keep visualizing a particular figure, for example, the refuge tree. And if you keep doing that, the jnana sattva arises, which is the being from its own side. And when the samaya sattva, the sort of the being that you're creating with your mind, gets filled out by the jnana sattva, something exciting happens. And in a sense, this is what we're looking for in the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice. We're looking for ourselves to be in a receptive and open state of consciousness, and to see the tree in a different way and allow that to become filled from its own side, allow the reality of the refuge tree to come through. And if that can happen, then there's a sort of mutual responsiveness between you and the image of the refuge tree. In a way, you're in the great mystery of image perceiving image. I was thinking about that as the Dharma door of non-duality, which is something we find in the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra. It's like, in a way, the samaya sattva, the visualization of the tree, and what the vision of the tree is from its own side are two. But when those come together, there's a great responsive to the mystery of the Dharma door of non-duality. That made loads of sense when I wrote it down. I'm not sure. It's very hard to talk about. But anyway, I just thought I'd finish I'll finish with something from the Rashtrapala Parikrita Sutra. But I just wanted to say that in a way that's our journey. Our journey is to illumine our own imagination, but also to allow that imagination to meet an image of the Buddha. That in a way is beyond us, but we also have to imagine ourselves. So we're allowing our illuminate imagination to meet the Buddha, which we're imagining, but supported by images around us that reflect the nature of the Buddha beyond our own intellect powered by craving. And this can be a creative tension, our own imagination and the image of the Buddha supported by the images around us. I think in a way it reminds me of the work of Arloka, who he has his own artwork, which is utterly different from his commissions. But something happens when he has to work with the form of the tradition, and something quite exciting emerges. And in a way, the structure of having the forms of the tradition does something to his artwork, which allows something new to come into being. So he needs to bring in himself and his illumined imagination, but he also needs to work with the actual structure of the existing Buddhist tradition. And I think we're all doing that all the time. We're all having to awaken our imaginations and work with a pre-existing religious tradition that's, you know, not originally from our culture. Anyway, so this is a very, very, very strange bit of the sutra, so don't try and understand it with your intellectual mind, because it's impossible. Then the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Pramodya Raja, having praised the Blessed One with these verses, cupped his hands together in salutation and beheld the realized one's body, the Tathagatakaya, with unblinking eyes, reflecting only upon the Dharma realm, penetrating what is deep, difficult to fathom, difficult to see, difficult to understand, incomprehensible, beyond reason, tranquil and subtle. Desiring the liberation of the Buddhas that is free from obstruction, and comprehending the body of the Buddhas, the Blessed Ones, to be unchanging, auspicious and eternal, he comprehends the body of the Realized One as extending through all Buddha fields and as directed towards all sentient beings. He calls to mind that even in millions of future aeons, there is no limit to the virtues of the Buddhas, the Blessed Ones. The Bodhisattva Mahasattva Pramodya Raja remained silent, pondering only the Dharma realm.